Welcome all to Audio Journal's Poets Corner, the program that offers its print-impaired audience and other listeners the opportunity to listen to poetry of people from all walks of life, of those from the distant past right up to the present day. This production is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm George Blomquist, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading poems that run the gamut of human emotions from poets such as Kalidasa, Regan Good, Robert Francis, and Amy Clampett, to name just a few. Today, we'll be considering these poets' take on the natural world, which has been a recurring subject of poetry, frequently the primary one, in every age and country. Indeed, the urge to describe the natural world and its marvels, with its various landscapes, changing seasons, and surrounding phenomena, has been intertwined with the human psyche since the beginning of time. Let's begin now by traveling back to the 5th century India and consider an excerpt from the Ritusamhara, the Gathering of the Seasons, written by Kalidasa, often considered the greatest poet and dramatist in classical Sanskrit literature. This particular excerpt regards the impact of the dry season in India upon animals and humans alike. It reads as follows. Antelopes suffering from summer's savage heat race with parched throats toward the distant sky, the color of smooth blended coal, thinking, there's water there in another forest. In an agony of pain from the sun's fierce rays, scorched by dust on his path, a snake with drooping hood creeps on his torturous course, repeatedly hissing to find shelter under a peacock's shade. The king of beasts, suffering intense thirst, pants with wide-open jaws, lolling tongue, quivering mane. Powerless to attack, he does not kill elephants, though they are not beyond his reach. Dry-throated, foaming at the mouth, maddened by the sun's sizzling rays, tuskers, in an agony of growing thirst, seeking water, do not fear even the lion. Peacocks, exhausted by the flamed rays of the sun, blazing like numerous sacrificial fires, lack the will to strike at the hooded snake, thrusting its head under their circle of plumes. Tormented by the hot sun, a herd of wild boars, rooting with the round tips of their long snouts in the cake mud of ponds, with swamp grass overgrown, appear as if descending deep into the earth. Burning under the sun's fiery wreath of rays, a frog leaps up from the muddy pond to sit under the parasol hood of a deadly cobra that is thirsty and tired. A whole host of fragile lotus plants uprooted, fish lying dead, saris cranes flown away in fear. The lake is one thick mass of mire, pounded by a packed elephant herd, pushing and shoving. A cobra, overcome by thirst, darts his forked tongue out to lick the breeze. The brilliance of his crest jewel flashes, struck by brilliant sunbeams. Burning from the summer's heat and his own fiery poison, he does not attack the assemblage of frogs. A herd of female buffalo, frenzied by thirst, emerges from the hill's caves, heads lifted up, sniffing for water. Spittle overflowing from cavernous jaws and frothing around their lips, pink tongues hanging out. A raging forest fire burns tender shoots to a cinder. Cruel winds hurl shriveled leaves high up with impetuous force. All around, water shrinks to the bottom in the sizzling heat. Oh, what a scene of horror that woodland's outskirts present! Birds sit, panting, on trees shorn of leaves. Lean monkeys troop into caves overgrown with bushes. Wild bulls roam around, looking for water. Elephant cubs diligently draw up water from a well. Relentlessly driven by the force of violent winds, the fire, brilliant as the vermilion petals of the mallow rose unfolding, speeds in every direction, smitten with longing to clasp the top of trees, bushes, and creepers, and burns the earth. Springing up at the skirts of the woodland, the fire's glare tires the creatures of the woodland. It blazes in the glens, fanned by the winds, crackles and bursts through dry bamboo thickets, and spreads in grass, waxing each moment. Incited by the winds, the wildfire roams on all sides of the woodland, seeming to assume multiple forms of the bright silk cotton groves. It glitters burnished gold in the hollows of trees and springs up tall trees to branches whose leaves are singed. With their bodies burning in the fire's fierce heat, elephants, wild bulls, lions lay aside their enmity and come quickly out of the grasslands scorched by fire, together, like friends, to rest on the river's wide sandy banks. Kalidasa is believed to have been a native of Kashmir, based on his vivid descriptions of the Himalayas. Seven of his works survive to this very day. Despite his devotion to Brahmanism, Orthodox Brahmins often avoided saying his name because of the stigma attached to the suffix dasa, meaning slave. We turn now to the wonders of nature in the modern city with the poem A Monstrous Catalpa Tree Grows from a Drain, by Reagan Good. You say your sunflowers are 15 feet tall? This catalpa is 30 feet, higher than the house. Soon the burdock and bitter dock will bury us in green. Our city feeds on jungle leaves the size of elephant ears. The catalpa pods hang enormous dangling beans. The catalpa tree does not enrich, nor does the monstrous burdock, be it bitter or curled. We laughed at how the catalpa eats men and cats, how its cheap matter foams at dusk to harden overnight. The catalpa feeds on wormseed oil and nightshade flower shine. The catalpa tree's leaves smother and its dagger beans stab. Hundreds of pods hang in clumps over our heads. Not to notice is worrisome, as one man moved once into the green through a side door, his skull pierced as he entered the catalpa's spacious mansion of enormous rooms, some spired and domed, some small and smoky, like cities across an oily river. You will find platforms where one can view new stars. If you climb high, you can hear the long wind, since each is a stream pulled from one overarching wind. The catalpa tree sprawls through the grate, growing overnight from sidewalk to sun tower. Picked, the beans turn black as the tree's leaves shrink to pea green, the pallor of the ripe stiff putrefying by the chain link. About this poem, Reagan Good writes, "My friend Jeffrey and I send each other photos of things we've seen during our walkabouts in the city. Transformers on the tops of skyscrapers, discarded zipped suitcases in Inwood Park, etc. But most often we are sending each other pictures of catalpa trees growing from bioswales and weird cracks in the sidewalks. The catalpa's leaves are jungle-sized, as big as a human head. The vegetal world of a city fascinates me. Worlds of steel, tar, and concrete can't stop plants from dispersing seeds. The seeds find some dirt, settle in, and, like Robert Lowell's skunks in Skunk Hour, they will not scare." Reagan Good is the author of The Needle, Harry Tankus Books, 2020, and The Atlantic House, Harry Tankus Books, 2011. The recipient of multiple residencies at McDowell, Yaddo, and the Fine Artwork Center, among other organizations, she is a professor at the Pratt Institute of Architecture. Our next poem is titled Blueberries, by Robert Francis. Faint blue, dark blue, their bloom untarnished, wild rose, ferns, the hay-scented brushing a granite boulder. Blueberries, high bush, low bush, and silence. Old-fashioned silence, a single towie, drink your tea. white clouds, sky pasture, blueberries, a bird's booty, a boy's occupation, stain of blueberry on a boy's mouth, and all around the blueberry-colored hills, dark blue, faint blue, blue beyond blue, the farther, the fainter. Silence, except once and again an invisible valley train, like a lost calf bawling, calling its mother. Is it Butter Hill, or the Northern Kearsarge, or the Little Hills of Concord, and Henry fresh out of jail, sun standing still? Sunday morning, gleam of white steeple bell unheard, oh, nothing heard at all, save solitary soliloquizing cricket. Sweet fern, John Greenleaf, and juniper, the blueberry pickers lost to one another, the August day ablaze on lonely hills. Here's a poem about one of the more amorphous forms of nature, titled Fog by Amy Clampett. A vagueness comes over everything, as though proving color and contour alike dispensable. The lighthouse extinct, the island's spruce tips drunk up like milk in the universal emulsion. Houses reverting into the lost and forgotten, granite subsumed, aroma in a mumble of ocean. Tactile definition, however, has not been totally banished. Hanging tassel by tassel, panicle foxtail and needlegrass, dropseed, third hawkweed, and last season's rose hips are vested in silenced chimes of the finest, clearest sea crystal. Opacity opens up rooms, a showcase for the hueless moonflower corolla, as Georgia O'Keeffe might have seen it, of foghorns, the nodding campanula of bellboys, the ticking linear filigree of bird voices. Amy Clampett was born on June 15, 1920, and brought up in New Providence, Iowa. She wrote poetry in high school, but then ceased and focused her energies on writing fiction instead. She graduated from Grinnell College, and from that time on lived mainly in New York City. Not until the mid-1960s, when she was in her 40s, did she return to writing poetry. At the age of 63, she published her first full-length collection, The Kingfisher, Alfred Knopp, publisher. In the decades that followed, Clampett published 5 books of poetry. The recipient in 1982 of a Guggenheim Fellowship and in 1984 of an Academy Fellowship, she was made a MacArthur Foundation Fellow in 1992. She was also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and taught at the College of William and Mary, Amherst College, and Smith College. She died of cancer in September of 1994. Next, A Winter Scene by Henry David Thoreau. The rabbit leaps, the mouse outcreeps, the flag outpeeps beside the brook. The ferret weeps, the marmot sleeps, the owlet keeps in his snug nook. The apples thaw, the ravens caw, the squirrels gnaw the frozen fruit. To their retreat I track the feet of mice that eat the apple's root. The snow dust falls, the otter crawls, the partridge calls far in the wood. The traveler dreams, the tree ice gleams, the blue jay screams in angry mood. The willows droop, the alders stoop, the pheasants group beneath the snow. The catkins green cast o'er the scene a summer's sheen, a genial glow. Now let's journey to the chilly environs of Alaska with the poem Spring Thaw by Dajee Nanook Okpek. A remnant conceals things I can't change. A blue glacial memory reveals light's sharp edges. I lean as if my body subdued by brittle gutter brim ice. Finding a chickadee's feather on a snowflake while lost in slumberous smooth blue smoke. I awaken to a chirping flock fly overhead. Indeed, grace. Dji Nanuk Akpik was born in Anchorage, Alaska, and is Inupiaq Inuit. A graduate of Kutunai College and the Institute of American Indian Arts, she also earned an MFA in creative writing from the University of Southern Maine's Stone Coast Program. A winner of numerous book awards, Akpik is a Lannan Foundation Fellow at the Institute of American Indian Arts. She currently lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. In her next poem, the poet looks back over her life struggles through the prism of the changing seasons in Rain Fugue by Jesse Redmond Fawcett. Slanting, driving, summer rain, how you wash my heart of pain, how you make me think of trees, ships and gulls and flashing seas. In your furious, tearing wind swells a chant that heals my mind. And your passion, high and proud, makes me shout and laugh aloud. Autumn rains that start at dawn, dropping veils of thinnest lawn, soaking sod between dank grasses, sweeping golden leaves in masses, blotting, blurring out the past, in a dream you hold me fast, calling, coaxing to forget things that are for things not yet. Winter tempest, winter rain, hurtling down with might and main, you but make me hug my hearth, laughing, sheltered from your wrath. Now I woo my dancing fire, piling driftwood higher, books and friends and pictures old, hearten while you pound and scold. Pattering, wistful showers of spring set me to remembering far-off times and lovers, too, gentle joys and heartbreak rue, memories I'd as lief forget, were not oblivion sadder yet. Ah, you twist my mind with pain, wistful whispering April rain. Summer, autumn, winter rain, how you ease my heart of pain. Whispering wistful showers of spring, how I love the hurt you bring. Jesse Redmond Fawcett was born on April 27, 1882, in Camden County, New Jersey. She was a poet, a novelist, and editor from the Harlem Renaissance. She's the author of several novels, including There Is Confusion, Bonnie and Live Right, 1924, and Plum Bun, Matthew and Merritt, 1928. Fawcett also served as the editor of The Crisis from 1919 to 1926. She died on April 30th, 1961. Next, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Let's now hearken back to the ancient city of Ur in Mesopotamia some 4,250 years ago with an excerpt from Inanna and the Subjugation of Mount Ebi by Enheduanna, the oldest named author in history. It reads, "When I, the goddess, was roaming heaven and roaming around earth, when I, Inanna, was roaming heaven and roaming around earth, roaming Elam and Subir, roaming the Lullaby Mountains, and turned to the heart of the mountain, I, the goddess, approached the mountain, and it did not fear me. I, Inanna, approached the mountain, and it did not fear me. I approached the peak of Ebi, and it did not fear me. I will fill the soaring peak with the fear of me." Pure Inanna took hold of a quiver. She raised a blistering storm of evil dust. She stirred up an evil blistering wind of potsherds. My lady encountered the mountain range. She went step by step. She sharpened both edges of her dagger. She took Ebi's neck as if tearing up grass. She pressed the blade into its heart. She yelled like thunder. The stones making up Ebi crashed down its back. From its sides and crevices, great horned vipers spat poison. She cursed its forest and damned its trees. She killed its oaks with drought. She put fire to its back and fanned its smoke. The lady spread the battle over the entire mountain. Pure Inanna had created what she wanted. She went to the peak of Ebi and said to it, "O mountain, because of your height, because of your elevation, because of your beauty, because of your adornment, because you are wearing a pure garment, because you extend to the heavens, because you did not put your nose to the ground, because you did not drag your lips through the dust, I have killed your heart and flattened you." Enheduanna was appointed high priestess of the temple of the moon god in Ur after her father, Sargon the Great, conquered the Sumerian city around 2330 B.C. Enheduanna maintained a personal devotion to Inanna, the goddess of sex and war. The hymn she composed, preserved in an old Babylonian literary catalog compiled for use in scribal copying exercises, are considered the oldest surviving works of poetry by an author whose name is known. Here's a poem from the pen of Worcester native Elizabeth Bishop, titled Sandpiper. "The roaring alongside he takes for granted, that every so often the world is bound to shake. He runs to the south, cynical, awkward, in a state of control panic, a student of Blake. The beach hisses like fat. On his left, a sheet of interrupting water comes and goes and glazes over his dark and brittle feet. He runs straight through it, watching his toes. Watching, rather, the spaces of sand between them, where, no detail too small, the Atlantic drains rapidly backwards and downwards. As he runs, he stares at the dragging grains. The world is a mist, and then the world is minute and vast and clear. The tide is higher or lower. He couldn't tell you which. His beak is focused. He is preoccupied, looking for something, something, something. Poor bird, he is obsessed. The millions of grains are black, white, tan, and gray, mixed with quartz grains, rose, and amethyst." We now conclude our program with Traveling Storm by Mark Van Doren. The sky above us here is open again. The sun comes hotter, and the shingles steam. The trees are done with dripping, and the hens bustle among bright pools to pick and drink. But east and south are black with speeding storm. That thunder, low and far, remembering nothing, gathers a new world under it and growls, worries, strikes, and is gone. Children at windows cry at the rain. It pours so heavily down, drifting across the yard till the sheds are gray. A county farther on, the wind is all, a swift dark wind that turns the maples pale, ruffles the hay, and spreads the swallow's wings. Horses, suddenly restless, are unhitched, and then, with glances upward, hurry in. Their overalls blow full and cool. They shout. Soon they will lie in barns and laugh at the lightning. Another county yet, and the sky is still. The air is fainting. Women sit with fans and wonder when a rain will come that way. You've been listening to Poets' Corner, a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you have any comments or suggestions for Poets' Corner, please let us know by calling us at 508-797-1117 or by emailing us at info@audiojournal.org or by mailing us at Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606. This program has been archived on our website, audiojournal.org, along with other Audio Journal programs. I'm George Blomquist, thanking you for listening. And now, stay tuned for other local programming brought to you by Audio Journal.
This is Bird Note. The harsh caws of American crows are one of the most familiar bird calls in North America. But a few crows in this flock sound like they've got stuffy noses. The birds aren't under the weather, of course. They're fish crows, a different species from the more widespread American crow. Fish crows are a little smaller than American crows. Otherwise, they look very similar. But their voices are distinctive. The American crow's hoarse caws. And the nasally calls of the fish crow. While they do love seafood, fish crows aren't limited to coastal areas. They're found in much of the eastern U.S., and the species seems to be spreading to new areas north and west to breed. In winter, fish crows join flocks of American crows looking for food in cities and landfills, where they'll sometimes squabble for a tasty morsel with a fellow scavenger like a raccoon or a gull. So, if you hear a bird in your neighborhood that sounds like it could use some cold medicine, keep an eye out for fish crows. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.